Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Al Franken podcast. I'm Al Franken. And today we're going to talk on a light subject, nuclear weapons. And our guest is Joe Cirincione, who happens to be the president of the Plowshares Fund. Now, I've worked with the Plowshares Fund for a long time, when I was in the Senate, certainly. They're a group that is trying to get us to spend less money, for example, on nuclear weapons, and to have reasonable disarmament talks with other nuclear powers. And they get their name from a quote in the Book of Isaiah, which I read every night. Okay, here it is. "And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift sword upon nation, neither shall they learn war any more." So they had to choose between we're going to be the Plowshares Fund or the Pruning Hooks Fund, and I think they chose wisely, and they have been great leaders on this extremely important task. So we're going to discuss that with Joe. We may get into, I'm not sure, Representatives Omar and Tlaib not going to Israel. These are the only two Muslim women who are members of Congress. Ilhan Omar is actually my member of Congress. I think you know the story. President Trump urged Netanyahu not to let them come in, and it got very complicated. Finally, they were going to let Tlaib in, Congresswoman Tlaib, to visit her 90-year-old grandma, and she chose not to go to the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, to visit her 90-year-old grandma because she said the conditions that were put on her to not talk about BDS, the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, that she wouldn't go under those conditions. You got a 90-year-old grandma, you know? Go there and say, "I think this is terrible. I can't talk about that stuff, and I will when I get home, but I want to see my 90-year-old grandma," because although I will say she looked pretty tough, the 90-year-old grandma, and she put a curse on Trump, and the curse wasn't, it was okay. It was, "May his hair start to thin and turn gray." And I don't think she realized that he's been dying the hair for quite a while, and that it has thinned out without the curse. So I think this is going to be a good one for a change. So enjoy. Now, Joe, I got to get your pronunciation right. Joe Cirincione?
Almost. Cirincione. There's a lot more
syllables. Not even close.
Not more syllables than you think. But you got the C right. Cirincione.
Like Cirincione.
Cirincione.
Joe Cirincione is my guest today here on the Al Franken podcast. And Joe is head of Plowshares. And is it Plowshares from the world, America? It's just Plowshares.
Just Plowshares Fund, yeah. We get the name from the Bible. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks.
But now it's sort of in the missiles.
We focus on nuclear since I've been president.
But I mean, the plowshares are being shaped in the missiles.
That's right. So we don't want to beat the missiles, but we do want to stop building more of them. That's exactly right.
What are the chances of that?
In my lifetime, not very good.
Really?
Yeah.
you have to understand, listeners, that Joe is 97 years old, which gives us all a little bit of hope.
It's in the balance. We're at a tipping point now. The reduction process has stopped. All the nuclear-armed countries are building more. There's a new nuclear arms race. So this is to be determined. Depends what we do.
Let me ask you. So this missile that blew up, looks like it blew up in Russia, right? What they wanted there was a nuclear-powered missile.
Yes.
Okay, explain that. It's in other words, it's not jet fuel or whatever. It's a nuclear engine within the missile.
So even if you don't care anything about nuclear arms control or nuclear weapons, this is just really interesting. This is just real. So this is a cruise missile. So you basically have two kinds of missiles. Mostly we talk about ballistic missiles. They go power, they go up in the atmosphere, they glide, then they come down, pulled by gravity.
Okay, I know that.
Oh, well, most people don't. The how a missile works. It goes up and it comes down. And what that means is it's got a predicted course.
People listen to the Al Franken podcast, I'd say 40% know that, at least.
I will take that bet. But okay, let's go on. So that's a ballistic missile. That means it's predictable. It has a predictable path. So if you detect it, you can plot it, and maybe you can put something
intercept
up there
it.
That will intercept it, maybe.
And if there's how many missiles do they have?
Long-range ballistic missiles?
Yeah, long-range.
Several hundred. They have hundreds of these.
Okay, so we'd have to
subs
hit all...
Subs and land base. Yeah.
Almost all 100.
Oh, it's impossible.
You could lose one city.
Is this a missile command? You know, it's like you can lose a couple cities and it's okay. But it's hard. So it's impossible to do that.
Right.
But the Russians
we better not rely on it. And that's what Star Wars was going to be. That was Reagan's thing, which was we were going to just have these anti-ballistic missiles and intercept them all.
And we were going to protect America from missiles the way a roof protects a family from rain. That's what Ronald Reagan said. Impossible.
Well, that's what he did. You know, I always like to say that a wise man once said, "Trust, but verify," and that man was quoting Ronald Reagan.
Well, he did. Reagan really believed you could do this. He was sold a bill of goods. And a lot of Americans actually think we have it, like we have a defense, that if somebody shoots a missile at us, that we can shoot it down. And that's because a lot of our generals tell us that, a lot of our political leaders tell us that. Nonsense. No, won't happen. Chance of doing it are minuscule. But suppose you do think that the other side has a missile defense system that can shoot yours down. Then what you want is a system that can't be shot down, and that's the cruise missile, because it goes under the defenses. It doesn't have a predicted trajectory. It can go.
How far can a cruise missile go?
That's why
the nuclear engine.
Exactly. Because most cruise missiles, most cruise missiles.
I read the paper.
You know, they carry jet fuel, and so they run out. So
they run out of jet fuel.
You know, 1,000 kilometers or so, not very long range, but at most, more like a couple of hundred, most of them. But what you can do, what if you had a fuel that didn't run out? What if you could put a nuclear reactor on the back of your cruise missile, and that nuclear reactor would propel the missile forward? And here's how it does it. The heat of the reactor is immense. It's intense, you know, as hot as the sun. And so it heats up the air and sends it out the back of the missile and propels it forward. That means you could keep this cruise missile going for very long distances or very long times, weeks at a time. It could go thousands of miles. In other words, you could launch
it could go around the Earth several times. Is that what you're saying?
As long as you wanted it to. But it could at least go across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. And now you have an intercontinental cruise missile, which has never existed before. And you have a system that a missile defense system cannot shoot down under any circumstances.
Okay, and they have control over it, obviously.
Yes.
Okay, so in other words, this is sending out a cruise missile that they have complete control over, and they can have it go around, orbit the Earth several times, and then decide, we haven't hit Cincinnati yet. Go to Cincinnati.
That's exactly right. So we had this idea back in the 1950s. The people were working on what we called Project Pluto. This was designed, it started in the 1950s and continued through the 1960s, which was a very large missile, about the size of a locomotive. That, yes, gigantic. Well, this one that we're talking about is about the same size. It's
They're big. Think, how big is a nuclear engine?
When we were going to design it, it would carry sub-bombs. It would have little bombs, and it would fly over the target area, Russia, and loiter around and could be dropping bombs, move on to another city, drop another bomb, etc. And this was going to be powered by a nuclear reactor in exactly the way I described. Heat the air, put it through a ramjet, propel it forward. And if you were worried about something, a crisis coming out, the idea was you could send it over the oceans and it could loiter for a while. So that was the idea. Never worked. We could never get it to work. I mean, you had big engineering
problems. But this one the Russians have developed evidently works, except for exploded.
Well, they've
except
had
that part.
U.S. intelligence reports this is probably somewhere around its 14th test, the longest test that we've been able to detect, only lasted about 2 minutes, so it's not been very successful, and this one exploded. And one of the problems with this thing is that the reactor, you know, in order to fit it on a missile, there's no shielding. So there's no lead walls, there's no concrete, so that means this thing just spews radioactivity. So for us, this became completely unacceptable because we'd have to be flying over, say, Europe with this cruise missile, and it would radiate all the territory it was flying over. And we decided this was too unworkable, too cruel, too stupid even for us. We canceled the project at 64.
Too stupid even for us? Is that what you just said?
Yes, even in those nuclear nuts days when we were building all kinds of nuclear weapons on all kinds of platforms. So here the Russians come, and they say, okay, we can do this. And they've been trying to do this. And what appears to have happened is there is some fuel in the cruise missile. You have to get it up to a certain speed in order for the ramjet to work. You have to get it going flying very fast in order for the heated air to be able to go in and come out at the acceptable speed. And apparently what happened was the rocket fuel blew up the nuclear reactor. So you had radioactivity spewing into the atmosphere, into the ocean.
This was flying. This was in the air?
It's unclear. We don't know yet whether it was flying or whether it was back on the barge. It appears to have been on the ship.
Really?
Yes, when it blew up.
Okay, so it wasn't, Okay, so how did it blow up just sitting on the barge?
Rockets blow up all the time. And this is why you don't make nuclear rockets. They blow up all the time.
So is HBO got another Chernobyl in a few years? Is that what we're saying here? Is this essentially that?
HBO, yes. It's a mini Chernobyl. But it's smaller. I mean, this was the Chernobyl, of course, was a major nuclear reactor. This is a small mini reactor. That show really influenced people's view of this. They really understood, one, what it means that you have radiation spreading over a large area. And they understood the Russian reaction, which was just like it's depicted in Chernobyl. They didn't tell you anything. They denied anything was going on. They put out false story after false story. We still don't know the whole truth.
And how many have died, or have they said died?
Seven died that we know of. And five of those were Rosatom scientists and engineers, the people who work for the Russian nuclear agency. That's one of the reasons we know this was actually a nuclear accident, one of the clues that makes us think it was this Russian missile called, the NATO designation is Skyfall.
Which is the Bond movie.
The Bond movie, Skyfall.
About a Russian missile that fails. No, it wasn't. Okay, so now let's talk about this in terms of the nuclear arms race.
Oh, yeah.
Because what I think I'm seeing here is that the United States and Russia, starting, I guess, with Russia here, have given up on arms control.
Yes.
I have the feeling that Putin wants the Russian people to think we're back. We're back. We're a superpower, and we're going to invest all this this capital in being a superpower, which means we're really dangerous. We're going to be a threat again to the United States and the rest of the world. And then the United States, here in the United States, Trump and other scientists and thinkers in this area are going like, they're coming up with new technology. It isn't enough to have the overkill that we have in missiles that used to be fine, But now things are the new technology. Technology doesn't stop. And if we stop developing anything, we're going to fall behind. And not just them, but the Chinese.
That is exactly right.
Ah,
and each of the nuclear armed states views the situation exactly like that. That it's the other guys that are racing, and so therefore they have to race. They have to keep up. And I think all of them are somewhat right and all of them are wrong. And what you produce is this dynamic where everybody is responding to the other person's moves. And that means that every single nuclear armed nation, there's nine of them in the world, are building new nuclear weapons. We are off and running. We're not on the brink of a race. We're not in danger of a race. We're in the race. If you miss the 1980s, this is what it looked like. This is what a nuclear arms race was like in the 1980s, slightly larger scale. But it's like this now, especially between the U.S. and Russia, who have about 95% of all the world's nuclear weapons. They are each building new weapons, new kinds of weapons, and developing new doctrines for how to use those weapons.
Okay, which brings us to the solution to that would be some kind of summit with the Chinese, the Russians, and us. We have just the right president for that. Someone with carries a lot of respect and weight around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about in the last Democratic debate, we had a little bit of a debate between Elizabeth Warren and Governor Bullock of Montana. He wanted to keep the first strike capability.
Yes.
Which says that there are situations in which the United States may want to be the first to use nuclear weapon. What are those situations?
We haven't had one in 74 years.
I know that.
Right. Well, think about that for a minute. The U.S. is the first and only nation to use nuclear weapons. We've come close. But we have been in a lot of wars. We've lost a lot of wars. We've lost brave men and women. We've had our allies lose. We've had efforts. We had the Joint Chiefs sometimes suggesting we nuke, for example, Cuba. We had the French, when they were under siege from Dien Bien Phu, asking us to drop nuclear weapons on the Viet Minh. We've had dozens of incidents like that. A president has never decided to use a nuclear weapon because they know that it's crossing a threshold.
Of course it is. So what I'm wondering about is, well, first of all, Secretary Perry, William Perry, right?
Yes.
Has written a book, and in it it opens with a false positive that they detect from the Soviet Union. Now, if this technology is coming faster, which I would assume, does the nuclear-powered missile travel faster?
No.
It
the
doesn't.
Ballistic missile is the fastest. It would fly from one continent to another in about 30 minutes.
Okay.
And of that time, you have about 25 minutes when you see it coming before it hits. And of that time, the president would have about 7 minutes upon notice to discuss and decide whether to launch a retaliatory strike.
Fortunately, it would be the longest 7 minutes of his life.
I have my own podcast called Press the Button. And in there, we do a news segment, and we time the news segment for 7 minutes just to illustrate how short a time that is.
You do that every podcast?
Every week, early warning. Yeah.
Wow.
And press the button. So we
Let's do that on this one.
Because it's an impossibly
starting
short
now.
Time. I mean, you can't decide whether you want to go out to see a movie in 7 minutes. You know, who's going to decide whether they should launch a nuclear weapon?
If your wife says, decide.
So then you
decide already.
Then you either you go, or in this case, you press the button and you launch a war. And the problem is, as William Perry describes, is you have false alerts. You think it's happening. I mean, every indication is that you are under attack. You think it's happening, but you're not. And that's when it's just a question of machines failing, of practice tapes being slipped in by accident to the early warning system, things like that. A misinterpreting a rocket launch, as the Russians did in 1995. They thought they were under attack, and Yeltsin was asked to press the button, and they decided not to. But what happens in this world where you have cyber attacks, where people might be intentionally trying to provoke you into launching, where you don't know if you've been hacked. And everything looks real on your screens. All your computer indicators are blinking red the way they're supposed to, and you launch and it turns out you've been spoofed. So that's you know, why you have to start to think about a change in doctrine. Now, we don't have to do that. This is called launch under attack or launch on warning. You don't have to do that. You don't have to launch your missiles first unless they're ICBMs, like Governor Bullock has in Montana. He has 150 ICBMs in Montana. He would like to keep those jobs and those contracts in the state of Montana. And his justification is these are what you need, but there's a liability with those ICBMs. If you are, in fact, under attack, they get hit and they're gone. On the subs, for example, the ones that Adam Smith has in the state of Washington, they're invulnerable. You can't find them.
Let me ask you about them, the missiles in North Dakota and in and Montana. Do we need those?
No, I don't think you do.
How much do they cost?
Well,
and maintain, and then are we building new ones or are we updating the old? I don't know what that even means.
Glad you asked. So North Dakota has a missile base, about 150. Montana has a missile base, and then there's one out in it straddles Wyoming, Nebraska, and Colorado. So 150, about 400
missiles. Now, are we giving up secret information?
No. You can look at this. You can do sky searches on Google Earth. You can see the silos. Not only is there nothing secret about it, I mean, there's obviously fences and guards and things like that.
Yeah.
But under the arms control agreements, START, Ronald Reagan's treaty, and New START, Obama's treaty, we have reciprocal inspections. So Russians come to Minot all the time.
Oh, okay.
And they do inspections. They have satellites that are allowed to photograph. We have lots of verification.
Okay.
And this is why a lot of the military likes arms control, because it gives them predictability. It gives them verifiability. They can understand what the other side is doing, and they're not going to be caught by surprise.
That's a very good idea. I don't even know what kind of nuclear arsenal the Chinese have. What do they have?
Fewer than 300 weapons, about 40 to 60 of which are on long-range missiles that can reach us. So that's a relatively small arsenal. That's all they wanted to build. I mean, they could build it larger, but they have something they call minimum deterrence. They correctly realize that that's all you need to deter the United States. We're not going to attack China. I mean, one city lost in an attack on China. If they launched one nuclear weapon against it, would be unacceptable. 10 would be a catastrophe.
Remember Failsafe, the movie Failsafe?
Exactly.
Henry Fonda, he has to let the Soviets bomb New York City because we screwed up and bomb Moscow, right? And his wife is shopping that day.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
I can just, can you imagine Trump having to decide, am I going to bomb the city Melania is shopping
in? Well, more importantly, his Trump Tower is in.
Yeah, but that means he gets to rebuild it.
Yeah. radioactive wasteland. Yes. So when
this is dark stuff, by the way.
Well, yeah, we're talking about the end of human civilization. We're talking about nuclear war. It is dark. So the Chinese have about 300. The U.S. and Russians have about 2,000 in their operational stockpiles. This is all their long-range missiles that can reach continents, plus another 200 or so short-range weapons and what they call hedge, plus another 2,000 or so that are in various states of dismantlement. So all told, the U.S. and Russia have about 6,000 each. China has about 300, France, U.K. about 200, India, Pakistan about 150, and then North Korea is knocking on the door. They got about enough material for maybe 20 or 30, maybe a little more. And that's the nuclear world right there. It's not many nations. Most of the countries in the world do not have nuclear weapons. There's only 9 that do. There's only 2 that have a lot of them. So, and the reason we're down to these numbers, which sound like a lot, that's a lot of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, this is...
But they're used to, all told, you add it all up, there's 14,000 nuclear weapons in the world. But when Ronald Reagan started the reduction process back in the 1980s, there was 70,000 nuclear weapons. And we've been coming down ever since until now. And now the reduction process has stopped. There's no further reductions. There's no talks about further reductions. There's no talks about talks.
The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply. I don't even hear this on the debate stage. We haven't had enough candidates, evidently, to really talk about this.
We haven't had a media that's been interested in asking him the question. We've had plenty of time to get into this. But when Jake Tapert asked Elizabeth Warren that question, it was a gotcha question. He knew that she what her position was. And the way they asked the question.
This was the first strike thing.
He said, why would you want to tie America's hands by saying you wouldn't be the first one to use a nuclear weapon? And she gave a great answer on this, that you want to reduce instability. We're never going to do it anyway. We don't want anybody to do this. You want to establish the principle that no one should ever be the first to use a nuclear weapon. Does it stop somebody from breaking that pledge? No. But it's one further restraint, one barrier that you have to cross.
If you break a pledge just once, how big a deal is it? No, but I would rather that – I mean, okay – the first strike thing is, I mean, that's our policy, though.
Our policy is to first strike.
Yeah.
And this is the problem, because when you start talking about the money, you know, all these weapons, I didn't get to answer this year, those missiles that are under the great prairies of America are wearing out. These were ordered under Ronald Reagan, and they wear out eventually. They got a 30, 40-year lifespan. So if you want to keep them, which we apparently do, you got to build a new one. That'll cost you $120 billion and about $2 trillion total to replace all the bombers, subs, missiles, and warheads that we have. So we're looking at that kind
of
deal.
Well, we have a triad.
Yes.
And we got to keep two legs of the triad.
Okay.
Okay, to have a deterrent.
And a lot of people recommend that.
Right. And I think the ones in Montana and the Dakotas, et cetera, will be the one we don't need.
That's exactly right.
I like an idiot. Obama invites the Democratic caucus in the Senate to the White House. I raise my hand. I go, why do we need these ICBMs? We have enough deterrent. Wow.
From Obama, but from your fellow senators?
I don't want to say who.
Well, I can tell you, there's in the Congress,
but
maybe
you
were not a member
Tester,
of it.
Tester, obviously.
Montana,
right?
So it might have been. Senators from North Dakota.
Dorgan.
They called it the ICBM caucus. People don't, they think this is, I'm making
well,
this up.
Well, I
did
up. Not, see, I should have known
it's
that.
It's an ICBM caucus, and it's all about jobs.
Also.
So it's 12
other
12
jobs,
states.
Because the labs are elsewhere, too.
Right, California.
New Mexico. They spread these jobs around.
Yeah.
Very smart.
And it's not a lot of money. You're talking about maybe 2,000 jobs in Montana, not a lot of money. You're talking about, say, Lawrence Livermore. It's about a $2 billion budget. But, man, they cling to those jobs. They cling to those contracts.
How good a job is that? How good a job? I mean, are there literally guys and women who spend their careers with another person because you need two to launch, right?
You need two to launch. If you're in the silo, you got to have two. It's a dual key
That's not
system.
Someone's whole career, is it?
And it's
sitting
not somebody's
in the
whole
silo?
Career, but it's a missile control launch officer, and they can spend 2 to 5 years in that job. I know.
Wow.
Being a missile officer is not a desirable job. I mean, it's for a lot of people, it's not their first choice. That's where they are. That's where they're stuck.
Sure, but I mean, what does... you don't know what the job entails. Like what you're not sitting someplace waiting for the call. You're going around. You're dusting.
It's a small
you're polishing.
The missile control chamber is a small area.
It's, but you, do you
it's
have
a little
to
larger than
there?
This studio.
Do you
but
have
not,
to be in the chamber?
You're on shift. Sure, you're on shift. You know, 12-hour shift. You'll be there. Yeah, you go down, and that's where you are. And then you spend the rest of the time on base, then you go back for another shift.
That's your job, 12 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty boring.
Okay, but there are two people.
Two people.
Okay, so if you get to know the other guy.
You better like him. You're in that little room for a long time. And then they do drills there, you know, keep people active.
Sure.
So one of the things you have to keep practicing and making sure that you will follow the order. They don't want people questioning you. This is as close to an automated system as you can get with having people involved. When they give the order to go.
We've got the code from President Trump.
That's exactly right.
Go. I mean.
Well, you don't want, they are trained not to have that moment. So some people think, well, look, even if the president of the United States is crazy, even if the law gives him unfettered authority to launch a nuclear weapon whenever he wants, mm-hmm. for whatever reason he wants, surely the military wouldn't carry out an insane command, would they? Well,
you know, at one point, remember when that anonymous letter came out to the New York Times from someone within the White House?
Yes.
So I just tweeted this. I said, now is not the time for the Secretary of Defense, Mattis at the time, to tell the president they're withholding the nuclear codes from him. Now is the time to give him the wrong codes.
Well, you know, so on the one hand, that's yes, you don't want the president to have that authority. On the other hand, wait a minute. You know, we've worked for hundreds of years.
You're violating the Constitution, but...
You're violating the Constitution?
But...
We have civilian control of the military in this country. You know,
that's the idea.
You want the military to do what the civilian president says.
I know.
But maybe this one time, is that what you're thinking?
I mean, Secretary Mattis, you're being court-martialed for saving the planet. And you're hereby sentenced to life in prison, and then we're actually going
to let you go.
Wow. Okay.
You remember, there was a great movie, one of the great movies of the 50s
Dr.
and 60s.
Strangelove?
That was a great movie, too, but I was thinking of 7 Days in May.
Oh, yeah.
7 Days in May. This is Burt Lancaster. Burt Lancaster is the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he leads a coup against the President of the United States. You know why? Because he was negotiating an arms control treaty with the Soviets. And he thought, this is surrendering America. And this, the whole issue was about who runs this. Who do you trust? Kirk Douglas, fortunately, is his chief of staff, and he sides with the president, and he helps thwart the coup. But this is the whole issue. You do not want the military to have control of the nuclear weapons and have ultimate authority on whether they can be used or not. So we're
on principle. On principle. Okay, let's get away from these horrible scenarios. I just think that it would be good for one of the presidential candidates to say, do you realize how many resources, how much money goes into these things? If we could negotiate so we all didn't have to spend this, we could be doing some great stuff with that. And we could be... educating therapists for the guys who've been in the missile silos, and we could, and for everybody else who's lived through the Trump administration, we could address climate change, for example. I mean, wouldn't it be a much smarter use of those resources? And all China and the Soviet Union and France and Great Britain and India and Pakistan and Israel, which I guess has it.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention Israel. Yes.
Yeah. All of them, except for us, are signatories to the Paris Accords.
Oh, yes.
And just think about, you know, you go, guys, let's just talk about not spending our nut on booze and coke. Let's spend it on the kiddies. Let's spend it on their future.
Right. Well, this is exactly why this is no longer an issue just for nuclear wonks or just for the national security community. Because you leave it up to the national security community, you know, that's dominated by defense contractors, and defense contractors fund and think tanks who do studies to say, yes, keep building more weapons. You're going to keep spending this money.
Right.
Right? So we got $2 trillion.
I want to go to an expert on this.
Right. So you
somebody from General Dynamics.
Yes.
You've been studying this for 30 years, haven't you? Yes, and I'm afraid we're going to have to build some new systems.
That is exactly what they say. That's exactly the way
they
talk. Did
I do a good impression?
Well, you got
the
baritone voice, the seriousness, the, you know.
It's going to cost a lot of money.
But?
But it's the only thing we can do. It's the only thing we can do for the survival of our democracy and our nation.
Yes, and we owe it to the men and women in uniform. Let's throw that in there.
We owe it to the men and women in uniform.
There we are.
There
See?
We are.
And then, and that's
See?
In this. And this works.
And this works. Oh, no, he wouldn't say that.
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, this rap, this line of thinking, this works. Okay, but, so if you leave it to the national security community and the contractors and the lobbyists who swarm all over Capitol Hill, you were on the receiving end of a lot of that, you're going to keep getting.
I'd say, get out of here, you. I know what you're up to. Get out of my office.
You're going to keep getting 738.
Oh, you'll max out? Huh. Come back. I see. Okay, but I may vote against you.
You were lobbied by defense contractors, right?
They did not come to me.
Minnesota,
I think they knew.
Not a lot of contracts in Minnesota?
There are contracts in every state, and you know that. They
right.
give contracts. There's a reason for that.
Yes.
They do that. They create jobs in every damn state.
Every congressional district.
Yeah. Because one thing I learned, and we're going to talk about Israel, and first, when I went to Israel as a senator, the first time I'd been there before, but when I went there before, I met with the Knesset, met with mm-hmm. members of the Knesset. And I realized that they all, every member of the Knesset represents all of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's small, so that makes sense, but it's because they have this parliamentary system, and everybody who, it's each party gets as many members as a percentage basis of their vote in the general election. In the United States Senate, you represent a state.
Right.
So what you're worried about are the jobs in Minnesota or the jobs in North Dakota or the jobs in New Mexico or Tennessee. I could name all 50 states, but I think you get the idea. So that's why these defense contractors put pieces of these projects in every state.
Exactly. Exactly. I used to work in the House Armed Services Committee in the 80s, and I remember when they had this breakthrough with the B-1 bomber, they placed a contract for the B-1 bomber in every single congressional district. 435 congressional. I don't know what the hell some of these people made, but there was 435
there
contracts.
There is a...
Screws, I don't know what.
There is a screw which has a special head that you have to screw in. So you have the screwdrivers.
That's in a different district.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
So you can't leave it up to them. You know, there's no way that the people who want to have arms control or want to cut the nuclear budget can succeed if they just work among themselves. It's got to form alliances. And there's no way that people who want Medicare for all can afford that if you keep spending this kind of money on nuclear weapons in the military budget. You might not be able to afford Medicare, let alone. And if you want the Green New Deal, where do you think you're going to get that money?
Well, that's the one.
I mean, you got to have trade-offs.
Theoretically.
And this can also give you better.
Single payer is less expensive. If you look at Canada, if you look at every other developed nation, covers everybody. And there's reasons to believe that you don't have to pay more for health care. In fact, there's evidence that if you have universal mm-hmm. care, that you can pay significantly less. So, but certainly.
The Green New Deal requires major new investments.
The Green New Deal or, you know, some version of the addressing climate change. The point is that we can be spending these resources instead of on.
Yes.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
How about, okay, let's go to this. The Space Force. We're the Space Force. That's another thing. Every branch of the service has an incredible theme. Off we go into the wild blue yacht from the halls of Montezuma. As the caissons go marching along. I mean,
these
they're
great songs.
Except, can you do the Coast Guard?
No,
you can't. You can't. And if you go to any Veterans Day or Memorial Days, they have a band that plays them all. You have veterans there, and they stand up when their branch, their theme is played. And every one of those is a brilliant, moving, spectacular theme, except the Coast Guard. And there aren't that many. The Coast Guard isn't that many. So you get this one guy who stands up to this. You know, not every piece of music can be great. We've learned that. You get an octopus's garden every once in a while. You know? What I'm trying to say is
the Space Force. Yeah.
What the hell?
Oh,
why do we need the Space Force? And is that going to be nuclearized? I mean, shouldn't we de-weaponize space not de-weaponize it, but not allow?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. When the Space Force idea was first announced, there was a couple of great articles reporters did on the origin of where this came from, and you won't be surprised to find out that it came from the aerospace industry. This is an idea that has been promoted by defense contractors to set aside a portion of the budget for satellites and missiles and launch vehicles and to guarantee that they would continue to get a big chunk of the dollars.
Well, we have
and an appeal to Donald Trump, who, for whatever reason, and he embraced this fringe idea. The Air Force doesn't like it. The Joint Chiefs don't like it. They don't think we need this. And so now they're in one of these dances where they're trying
to accommodate. And he brings it up every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to cheers for this crowd. But it seems like demilitarizing space would be an excellent idea. Now, the Chinese are working on anti-satellite weapons, right?
Yes, yes.
And that's friggin' scary because then you can blind us, right?
Yes, yes.
Yep.
And even the testing of them is dangerous. You put hundreds, thousands of fragments into low Earth orbit, you're going to knock out lots of the satellites we depend on for our basic, for going to the ATM, for example.
How do those work?
Anti-satellite weapon work?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a ground launch missile, or sometimes it's put on, one version we have, we put it on an F-15, brought it up as high as we could go, and then launched it into space. And it's basically an air-to-air missile, except it goes into space. And again, you're dealing with something that has a predictable trajectory. So you know the satellite's going around. You know exactly where it's going to be at what particular time. So you can plot an intercept.
And what do? They put a satellite in the space and then blow it up?
Well, that's another version. So instead of you can have a direct ascent anti-satellite weapon that just goes up and goes right at the satellite and blows it up. And there's another version where they're killer satellites. So you put them up in space, and they maneuver close to the target satellite.
Okay, isn't it time that we had a treaty between China and Russia and us saying, let's not do that?
That's exactly right.
Don't do that.
That's exactly right. Because you go into that race, there's no, you know, who's going to win that race? Are we going to win it? Is China going to win it? Is Japan going to win it? I mean, this is, you don't want to put your key economic assets at risk this way, or your military assets. So it's in our interest to negotiate what they call an anti-satellite weapon treaty. Yeah, this has been an idea that's been around. It's been blocked by those who want to build these weapons.
Who are they? Who are they?
First, there's the people. I mean, in all of this, you got to go back to the money. You know, it's follow the money. Who's making the money off of these weapons? And there's the big five defense contractors: Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics, etc. And then there's the politicians who represent states where these weapons are built or are beneficiaries of campaign contributions. And then on top of that, and only then on top of that, do you have the sort of strategic debate, the experts who are funded by think tanks or institutes.
The reason we have talked about a space force is to bring the Chinese to the table, you see, on the treaty on anti-satellite weapons. And I'm speaking now for President Trump. He has thought this through, and that's why he is acting kind of like a buffoon about the Space Force, but he's really actually playing three-dimensional chess.
Ah, yes.
That's what's happening here, and that's what's happening pretty much with everything he does.
That's right.
Yes.
So you can put a strategic veneer on any stupid idea and make it sound...
I don't understand why they don't just get someone like that, but that is their spokesperson.
That's right.
You just don't understand how brilliant this guy is. And some of this is secret, so we can't really... I can't give you complete answers often, but let me just tell you that just being in the man's presence, the level of detail, what he takes home to the residence at night and devours is just amazing. And you know, it's funny when people, experts, come in to brief President Trump, so often he is way ahead of them.
That's right. You know, have you ever seen a photo of President Trump carrying a briefcase? Folders?
It's all in his... He does it electronically.
Yeah.
He's very, very...
he's a great listener.
Tech savvy.
Yeah.
And... he likes to be underestimated. Let's just put it that way. And he is succeeding. Okay, let's talk about Israel and, of course, the Tlaib and Omar, the two congresswomen who were basically denied entrance into Israel.
I do think we're at a turning point in America's relationship with Israel and maybe Israel's relationship with us. And I speak about this from both a sort of political angle, somebody who's been in the national security field for 35 years in this town, but also a personal angle. I'm not Jewish, but my family is. My wife is Jewish. My kids are Jewish. My grandchildren are Jewish. Many, many, many of my friends are Jewish. And I've seen the change. You're Jewish.
I'm Jewish. I don't like to say it.
So I've seen the change. I mean, I've seen the change in my lifetime. And my wife, you know, my family was strong supporters of Israel. My wife was in Young Judea. My in-laws made Aliyah. They emigrated to Israel.
That means they're citizens of Israel. But they made it and they stayed there.
They stayed there.
I see.
I got a niece and nephew in the IDF. A goddaughter went in the IDF, was a sniper on the guys at Gaza Strip. And I've seen this change from a period where Americans, not just Jewish Americans, but Americans, you know, had strong support, visceral support for Israel.
Bipartisan support.
I mean, this was the brave new nation. This was the security for the Jewish people. This was the refuge for Jews from all over the world. These were the young, beautiful people building a new society. And it wasn't just about security. It was about new ideas, about new values. The kibbutz movement, make the deserts bloom.
Yeah,
Is that how you think of Israel now? No.
Of course not. You think of Netanyahu, you think of Sharon, you think of...
walls and barbed wire and armed forces and keeping a million people in the largest open-air prison in the world, Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
And you think of the settlers. And you think of all this. And what that means is that Jewish American sentiment has waned. We no longer identify with Israel. My kids don't care about Israel. They both did birthright trips. They both went mm-hmm. over there. They enjoyed
birthright
the trip.
trips are trips that American Jews get. They're paid for, right?
Free.
Yeah, free trip to Israel, and you know,
it's an immersive experience. Most people come back liking it, but they don't identify. Israel is not one of their priorities. It's not politically. They don't vote on Israel. They don't contribute.
On the
to
other
Israel.
Hand, though, there is this BDS movement, which is active on campuses, which I think is dangerous. But if
that's one way.
Maybe Netanyahu is someone who it's really hard to look right. at this guy and go like, yeah, I really want to get behind Israel, you know, and building these settlements to make it impossible to have a two-state solution. I don't understand it. And what the Republicans have done, what McConnell did, what Trump is doing now, is not in Israel's long-term interest.
Absolutely not. And this is the political element of this now, because Bibi has changed this. You know, when he was first elected, my family thought he was an aberration. He was a buffoon, a thug, a clown. And in fact, he only had a short first term, but then he came back. And he's now the longest sitting prime minister in Israel history. And he has fundamentally transformed Israel, in part because Israel's population has changed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. A lot of different immigration has happened in Israel, a much more conservative base that supports his kind of what I would consider racist policies and policies that support a permanent occupation, even annexation of the West Bank. And then it's not just that how bad those policies were, because many politicians have supported that. It's the way he translated that into the U.S.-Israel relation. He made it a partisan relationship. He had
and McConnell
went right along with it. The Republican
went right along
Party.
With it.
So he violated the cardinal rule. You know, you work with Republicans and Democrats. No, he's working with the Republicans. He's clearly made an alliance with the Republican president of the United States, and the Republican president has made an alliance with him. And it's an alliance between two autocratic leaders, not between two peoples, not between two nations. It's not in Israel's national security interest to have this, to break this bond. And you see it transforming in front of our eyes. And the decision to deny admission to Israel, to the West Bank, for two members of Congress, happened to be the first two Muslim women elected, I think is that tipping point is where it starts really demonstrably goes the other way, and you start breaking the bond between the Israeli people and the U.S. Congress.
All of this breaks my heart. It breaks my heart that Netanyahu is doing it. It breaks my heart that the settlers are making it impossible, I think, to put together a two-state solution. It breaks my heart that we have missiles coming from Gaza. I was born in 1951 in the shadow of the Holocaust. I understand why
yes.
Israel's there.
Right.
I don't think most people understand what percentage of the Jewish population of the world were eliminated during the Holocaust. It was like more than a third.
Yeah.
And this was an attempt to eliminate Jews from the planet. And if you look at the history, this was the ancient homeland of the Jews. There's no, and for a long friggin' time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Abraham is what, 4,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, this was a long time, but Jews got kicked out of Israel. We lost some battles there and have been going throughout the world, and everywhere they went, they would be successful until a certain point and then kicked out,
yes.
if not killed.
Yes.
And so finally, after the Holocaust, I mean, we were blamed. When I say we, I meant, you know, Jews were blamed for the plague,
mm-hmm.
the Great Plague. I mean, that was Jews were poisoning wells. So we would just have to go from, and my grandparents came from Russia because of pogroms,
yeah.
right? And I do think that part of this loss of support for Israel is due to the further we get away from the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. that's part of it. And then part of it is the fault of Israel. And part of it is the fault of the situation to begin with, which was that, okay, for centuries, Jews have been persecuted and oppressed and killed, and now this Hitler guy almost mm-hmm. eliminated them. They need a homeland. And that's what the international community did. Mm-hmm. And the only problem was that there are other people living there.
Yes. So you need a political solution to that. And the solution is not to drive Israel into the sea, but it's also not to occupy Palestine and expel Palestinians from their historic land. You need a two-state solution.
And that's why you need a Jared Kushner.
To come in.
To come in and find the solution. Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm sorry these were such heavy topics, and
we had a lot of laughs over the heavy topics, and that's what the Al Franken podcast is all about. Is
laughing at the darkness.
That's right. We don't curse the darkness; we laugh at it. See you all next time on the Al Franken podcast. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.